Did you know that you can grind up crickets into a powder and then use that powder to make food, and you'd never know that you're eating crickets? Crickets are one of the most sustainable and nutritious protein sources in the world, and EXO, EXO, is making tasty, nutrient-dense cricket protein bars made with only natural ingredients. They're made by a chef with 3 Michelin stars, and they're good for the environment, and they're good for you. So head to exoprotein.com/so smart to try 4 different bars for less than $10. That's exoprotein.com/so smart. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 90.
Bring her back online. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm not feeling quite myself.
You can lose the accent.
This is the first scene in HBO's new series, Westworld.
Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
That's right, Dolores. You're in a dream. Would you like to wake up from this dream?
In the show, Westworld is a theme park in the future in which people pay huge sums of money to immerse themselves in a sort of real-world version of a role-playing video game like The Witcher or Skyrim or Grand Theft Auto or Red Dead Redemption or something like that. And when they do this, when they go into this world that's been created for them, they interact with a population of robots that are indistinguishable from human beings. And in this first scene in the show, we see technicians interviewing an android, actually, to be technical, a gynoid named Dolores, who seems to have suffered some kind of malfunction. And they inspect the androids and their states of mind, their programming, their codes, by talking to them directly.
Would you like to wake up from this dream?
Yes. I'm terrified.
There's nothing to be afraid of, Dolores, as long as you answer my questions correctly. Understand?
Yes.
Good. First, have you ever questioned the nature of your reality?
Have you ever questioned the nature of your reality? Well, that is what this episode is going to be about. We're going to talk to a neuroscientist who, before he became a neuroscientist, worked in artificial intelligence, and he's the perfect person to talk to about all these things. But that's coming up in a minute. I just wanted to take a second and talk about this thing, this Westworld phenomenon that I am obsessed with. Oh, it's so my jam. And you know it is, because if you've ever listened to the show, you know I'm into all these things that the show explores. In the show, they ask the androids all the time, have you ever questioned the nature of your reality? And it's an on-the-fly Turing test to see if they've become conscious. And that idea comes up a lot in the show because Westworld ultimately explores what is consciousness. And will artificial intelligence ever reach a state that we could consider conscious in the way that we think of ourselves as such? You may recall all the way back in the 4th episode of the show, years ago, we had cognitive psychologist Bruce Hood on the program, and I asked him this question.
Since you're a super expert in this, I would love to hear your thoughts on one of my favorite concepts in science fiction. Do you think that perhaps a similarly complex interconnected network could give rise to consciousness and be self-aware, like a very complex AI or something like that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'd have to say I agree with you because I'm a materialist, so I don't believe that there are spirits and souls. And if you are a materialist and you believe the brain is a very complex system of structures and neural networks, and frankly, you know, the number of potential patterns is, you know, almost infinite. You can't say infinite, but it's almost infinite. Then yes, there's no reason why a sufficiently sophisticated system could become self-aware. Because otherwise you'd have to have a non-materialist account, which would then introduce pixie dust and spooks and souls and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And whilst they may exist, I'm not denying that they don't exist. I just haven't seen any reliable good evidence for them. And we do know that if you change the brain, you change the self. You know, so there's a lot of good evidence for materialism and precious little for non-materialism.
In that episode, Bruce Hood goes on to say that there is one big caveat, of course. The brain is incredibly complex, and it takes many years to build up that complexity. 100 billion neurons wired together into 100 trillion connections, or about 1,000 connections per neuron, makes the possible number of patterns of connection in the human brain more numerous than the number of atoms estimated to exist in the entire universe itself. Yes, that's patterns, not connections. So that's how that number can work out to be so big. So that's why consciousness is considered to be the hard problem of science, harder than anything else we've ever tried to solve, so difficult that some scientists think it's unsolvable. It also means that we've made very little progress into understanding the nature of consciousness, why it exists, how the goop in your head gives rise to thoughts and emotions, what is the self, and so on. Some of our oldest hypotheses are still just as likely as the ones put forth in recent years. It's just so difficult to sort out what is a reasonable idea when it comes to these mysteries. In fact, one of our most recent hypotheses that got a lot of press in 2014 was featured in Westworld. In the show, the creator of the park, Robert Ford, is played by Anthony Hopkins, and he often brings up theories concerning the mysteries of consciousness. Here he is talking about the one that I just mentioned.
I read a theory once that the human intellect was like peacock feathers, just an extravagant display intended to attract a mate. All of art, literature, Beethoven, Mozart, William Shakespeare, Michelangelo, and the Empire State Building. Just an elaborate mating ritual. Maybe it doesn't matter that we have accomplished so much for the basest of reasons. But of course, the peacock can barely fly. It lives in the dirt, pecking insects out of the muck, consoling itself with its great beauty.
Oh, and early in the show, Hopkins mentions an idea that caused a big stir in 1976. And I was thrilled when they mentioned this. It came from psychologist Julian Jayne's book, The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind.
The idea that primitive man believed his thoughts to be the voice of the gods. I thought it was debunked.
That's a theory for understanding the human mind, perhaps, but not as a blueprint for building an artificial one. You see, Arnold...
The bicameral mind was such a challenging idea, and so mind-bending that, well, we're still talking about it, right? We're talking about it right now. It's in this show. It's in this episode of Westworld. And it's contentious. Plenty of scientists today, they just think it's ridiculous. But plenty of others give it some credit. And in philosophy, it gets a lot of credit. The idea is that bicameralism, bicameral meaning two chambers, two rooms, is a theory of consciousness in which part of the mind, part of the brain, is giving commands, and the other part is hearing those commands and either obeying them or disobeying them. And so when you hear those thoughts without a concept of the brain or the mind, you assume they come from elsewhere. Now, we don't know what the Greeks truly thought or felt in their minds and their subjective experiences as conscious beings, but Jaynes and other researchers speculate that because they didn't think of themselves as even having minds at all, they still didn't have any knowledge of the brain. In fact, they didn't even know what the brain was for, that the mind as an idea, as a concept, had yet to be invented, and so they just had bodies. And when they saw things, they had memories of things. They thought seeing and remembering took place inside their eyeballs. When they felt afraid, that feeling happened in their hearts and in their stomachs. When they felt inspired, that was in their chest because they went, when they were inspired, inspiration. You see, these are all pretty much supported by the things that we read in their literature from the records that we can find. And Jane said that since these people probably didn't have a concept of a mind or a word for it, they likely assumed when they had inner thoughts like, I would like a slice of carrot cake, they didn't think that came from their inner selves. Instead, it came from the voice of an external agent. Instead of, I would like a slice of carrot cake, they heard, they intuited, go eat some carrot cake. And that came from somewhere. And if it didn't come from a mind, remember they don't have a concept of this, they assumed the source of those seemingly unbidden thoughts came from the most logical source they could think of, a god. Or so Jane said. Now, we sometimes think in this way today, a version of it. You know, we say that our drives and our desires and our bad habits and all that stuff come from particular parts of our brain, and ourselves, our conscious brains, must deal with those drives, must overcome them. And we can see that if you labeled those things as gods, it's not much of a stretch to see where Jane's was coming from. And here's where he's coming from. Here's the thing that shook everything up when he put out the book. He said that because they didn't have a concept of consciousness, they weren't conscious. Consciousness came later. The philosopher Daniel Dennett, writing about the bicameral theory, said that he thought that the idea was completely plausible. He said, quote, to put it really somewhat paradoxically, you can't have consciousness until you have the concept of consciousness, end quote. In the same essay, he compares all of this to the idea of history. Jaynes said that history as a concept had to be invented before we could think in historical terms. Yes, there was history before historians, but Dennett asks, quote, is there a history of lions and antelopes? Just as many years have passed for them as for us, and things have happened to them, but it is very different. Their passage of time has not been conditioned by their recognition of the transition. It has not been conditioned and tuned and modulated by a reflective consideration of that very process. So history itself, our having histories, is in part a function of our recognizing that very fact. You can't have baseball until you have the concept of baseball. You can't have money before you have the concept of money, end quote. So if Jaynes was right, and if Dennett is reading him correctly, the fact that we can't imagine consciousness at a certain point in our history means that it didn't exist. Without it, we can't frame ourselves in those terms, and we aren't truly conscious. Like I said, maybe all this is nonsense. But one of the most incredible things about neuroscience is that ideas like these, which would have been trapped in philosophy and speculative psychology, are actually being tested right now. And even weirder ideas are emerging from that investigation. Even stranger questions are now possible because sometimes we actually get answers. For instance, one of the first questions I think anyone asks once they start to think in weird, abstract terms is, do we all see the same colors? Like, when I see what I call green, do you see the same exact thing or something different? And since we both call it the same thing, how would we ever know if we actually had two different experiences when looking at that wavelength of light? Out here, in the world of lay people or, you know, non-scientists, that seems like a whoa, dude, bong, rip, magnets, how do they work kind of question. But if you ask it of a neuroscientist, you'll get a concrete answer. So do we all see the same color?
We actually know that even among people that are color normal, that there are wide variations in our color perceptions.
That's neuroscientist Donald Hoffman.
I'm Don Hoffman, and I'm a professor at the University of California, Irvine, and you can just call me Don.
And Don has come up with a, well, it's an idea, it's a theory, it's a hypothesis that is maybe even more challenging than the bicameral theory of consciousness. And we're going to talk all about that in a second, but here's the rest of what he had to say about seeing colors.
For example, among color normal males, there are two alleles of the red cone photopigment gene, and they differ by a single nucleotide, but that changes one amino acid in the pigment, and that changes the receptive properties, the peak sensitivity of that. And so when you actually test these men, you can actually, about two-thirds of the men have one allele, one-third have the other. You take them into the lab, do genetic testing, separate them into the two groups, and you find that they actually make different color matches. So even among so-called color normal, you know, males and females, there are these wide differences. And then, of course, 7% of males are red-green colorblind, and about 0.5% of females are red-green colorblind. And then there are some females that apparently have four color receptors instead of just the normal three, and they actually have an extra dimension of color perception that the rest, that no male has, and that most females don't have. And it's so there, you know, if I ask you to imagine a specific color that you've never seen before, right, nothing happens. I, you know, smoke comes out of my ears, but nothing happens.
Right.
But these women apparently are living in a world of colors that the rest of us can't even imagine concretely. So yes, we all use words the same way when we describe colors, and it's easy to assume that we're seeing the same colors, but we actually know that that's false.
My name is David McCraney. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. And in this episode, we are exploring reality itself, consciousness, what is real, what is perception, what is reality. All of that is the focus of this episode. And we're going to talk to Donald Hoffman, a neuroscientist who has a strong background in artificial intelligence, about his new theory, his new hypothesis, his new idea called conscious realism, which, well, it's just too complicated to even get started right now. He's going to tell you all about it, and I promise you it is going to twist your mind right after this commercial break. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website. It is easy to use Squarespace. Building a website with Squarespace is a simple and intuitive process. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse. You get a free custom domain, and they make adding that domain very simple. You just sign up for a year, and you receive a custom domain free for a year. You can design a best-in-class online store with Squarespace's award-winning templates, customizable settings, and more, all without a single plugin. And they have seamless commerce tools. From nationally recognized brands to your favorite local shops, Squarespace is trusted by hundreds of thousands of savvy shop owners around the world, including all the tools you need to track inventory, process orders, and send custom emails in one intuitive interface. Squarespace Commerce allows you to understand every aspect of your business. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter the offer code SOSMART to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, set your website apart. You all know how important seeking real knowledge is to me, and that's why I continue to watch lectures from the Great Courses Plus. And this is a really great way to gain insights into so many fascinating ideas, fascinating concepts through their many fascinating courses, and they keep adding more each month. If you want to discover the Great Courses Plus too, they're offering my listeners a full month of free video courses when you sign up using my special URL. It is thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. The Great Courses Plus has engaging video lectures from award-winning professors, and this offer allows you to get this month of lectures for free. You can watch any of their courses, hundreds of courses, on a variety of topics like history, science, psychology, economics, even photography. When you sign up, I recommend that you watch The Hidden Factor, Why Thinking Differently is Your Greatest Asset. You get tools to train your brain to think differently, helping you work better as an individual and as part of your team. So how do you do that? What's in the course? Professor Scott E. Page, a professor of political science and complex systems, takes you through ideas that will be instantly applicable to work. Stuff like Fermi's Barbers, The Wisdom of Crowds, Diversity Prediction Theorem, Homophily, Groupthink, Diversity, and more. You can watch this and whatever else you want with that free month. Anytime, anywhere, from your mobile device, tablet, laptop, or TV. Sign up today to start your free month of courses. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. My name is David McCraney. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. And on this episode, we are interviewing Professor Donald Hoffman, a cognitive scientist at the Department of Cognitive Sciences at the University of California. He has a PhD from MIT in computational psychology, and he's been studying artificial intelligence and human cognition for a very long time, leading up to a new theory that he's developed about human consciousness and what it really is. He recently gave a talk at TED, and the name of the talk is Do We See Reality as It Is? It has been viewed at this point more than 2.2 million times. So that question.
Have you ever questioned the nature of your reality?
Yes, he has. That's pretty much all he does. All right, let's pick his brain.
I'm wondering, and I've just been very eager to hear from someone who would know exactly the answer to this question or would have great speculation on this. What do you think of that whole bicameral theory of mind, the idea that we were monists for a very long time until the idea of dualism became common enough that we started to reframe our concept of consciousness in that way?
Well, the book, of course, was quite popular and had quite a following. Among scientists, it doesn't have much cachet at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting speculation, and it's fine to speculate, but the evidence is pretty much against those kinds of claims. We've made a lot more strides into what neuroscience really tells us about the nature of our perceptions and also our thoughts about consciousness. And do we really? He does claim that the Greeks perhaps heard the voices of gods because they externalized their own internal thoughts, things like that. Interesting speculation, but you won't find any serious scientist who has taken that as the foundation of their work.
Well, that is a good segue into your stuff, because you have been I wouldn't say exactly. It's not an identical kind of challenge, but you certainly have introduced ideas into academia, and as you've demonstrated, you are a empirical scientific explorer of things. You're a neuroscientist. You're not one of these sort of Rupert Sheldrake type. Not to disparage Rupert Sheldrake, but despite all that, you have these some very challenging ideas, and I'm going to run through this sort of in a way as we can ramp up to it. You say that in your TED talk that we've
We've made very little progress in understanding the relationship between brain activity and conscious experience. And even though we've really, really worked hard on this problem, it seems like, why is it we've made such little progress? And why are there so many of these ideas that can get really fringy and speculative, yet they're all kind of considered in, they're almost all regarded equally at this point, even if there's contention among neuroscientists? Why has there been such little progress on this specific problem?
Well, we actually call it the hard problem of consciousness, partly because we've made no progress in actually proposing a specific scientific theory that has any beef to it at all. And there is some speculation about why we've made no progress. One speculation is that we just don't have the conceptual systems that are necessary to solve this problem. We don't expect monkeys to solve problems in quantum mechanics. And it might be that Homo sapiens simply is not equipped with the concepts needed to solve the problem of how is consciousness related to our brain activity. That's certainly possible, and I can't rule that out. I mean, I do take evolutionary theory quite seriously, and that it's certainly quite possible that we don't have the concepts. But I think that there's a different reason, and that is that we've simply made some false assumptions. So, and that was how I began to look at this, because I mean, like everybody else, was trying to figure out how brain activity could cause our conscious experiences. And I couldn't think of anything intelligent to say about that. I mean, much less frame a theory. And when you look at all the so-called theories out there, for example, integrated information theory or orchestrated collapse of microtubule states and so forth, when you actually look at them, there's no beef. There's nothing. For example, there's no specific account for any particular conscious experience, like say the taste of chocolate. What integrated information state of the brain is identical to chocolate that's never been put out there? I mean, I've asked Tononi in person just a few weeks ago. There's not one concrete. They have no concrete case that they can point to. So we now know that this causal integrated structure is chocolate, and this other one is the taste of a lemon, and here's the principal reasons why. There's nothing remotely like that, and no idea about how to even get that. So I think that the reason that we've not made any progress is that we've made a very, very simple but false assumption. We've assumed that our perceptual systems give us some indication about the nature of reality as it is. That we evolved, of course, to stay alive, to be fit, and to have offspring, and that in the process of evolving perceptual systems that kept us alive, we evolved perceptual systems that showed us reality as it is. Not exhaustively. We don't see all of the truth, of course. No one believes that. But that our perceptions of a world in terms of space and time and physical objects that seem to have causal powers, like, you know, a white, the cue ball hits the eight ball and knocks it into the corner pocket. We think that there's genuine causality of physical objects in space and time because that's the way we see the world. That assumption is the one that I've been looking at. And then the reason I've been looking at that is that we've assumed that certain objects in space and time, namely neurons, have the causal power to create our conscious experiences. And so that was the question that I went after. Is that assumption right? When we make that assumption, we can't get anywhere. When we assume that neurons cause our conscious experiences, and neural activity causes our behavior, we run into deep, deep problems. In fact, we can't make any theoretical progress. So I said, let's step back and ask ourselves the question, does evolution by natural selection favor perceptions that are telling us about reality as it is? Does perception evolve to see the truth?
So this is your big challenge because this is what I learned in school is the idea that that, you know, the brain, yes, the brain constructs reality. It's a virtual reality. That was communicated pretty well, but it also our ancestors who saw a more accurate picture of, or had a more accurate perception of the objective reality that we don't completely bring into our minds, but the ones that had a more accurate perception of it were more successful. And so it's over time, it's becoming, you become more fit by becoming, having more accurate perceptions that better fit reality and so on. So, and you challenge this completely, correct?
That's right. You've, I think, nicely summarized the standard view in the field, that those of our ancestors who saw more accurately had a competitive advantage over those who saw less accurately and therefore were more likely to pass on their genes that coded for the more accurate perceptual systems. And so we can be quite confident that we don't see all of reality as it is, but we do see some of reality, namely the part of reality that we need. We see it accurately. And that was the very question, the very assertion that I then questioned. We don't have to wave our hands. Evolution by natural selection is a mathematically precise theory. We have the tools of evolutionary game theory, evolutionary graph theory, and genetic algorithms. And so we can pose a precise mathematical question and ask, under what conditions would natural selection favor veridical, that's the technical, the geek term that scientists use, veridical perceptions, namely perceptions that are accurate to reality. Not exhaustively, but wherever we might need them. And so I posed that question with some of my graduate students, and we ran Monte Carlo simulations where we simulated hundreds of thousands of random worlds and put organisms in those worlds that could see all of the truth, part of the truth, or none of the truth. And the ones and there were these things called fitness functions, which tell you how many fitness points you get for various actions you take, right? That's the name of the game in evolution, is that in addition to reality, there's a fitness function that governs, your success in reproduction. And what we found in our simulations was that organisms that saw reality as it is could never outcompete organisms that saw none of reality and were just tuned to fitness, as long as they were of equal complexity. And then, I conjectured a theorem. And the theorem that I conjectured is that an organism that sees the truth can never be more fit than an organism of equal complexity that doesn't see the truth and is just tuned to fitness. And I worked with a mathematician friend, Chetan Prakash, and proved the theorem. And so it's under review right now, but it's actually a theorem that if our perceptual systems evolved by natural selection, then the probability that we see reality as it is in any way is zero, precisely zero.
Okay, so this is a lot to unwrap. So this is now one of the things is, first of all, the first thing that's exciting about this is an idea that you would think would be trapped in philosophy forever. But here it is, way outside, not even just in psychology, but it's over here in computer modeling and evolutionary science and in neuroscience. And so you've pulled it way over here and put it into a framework where it can actually be peer reviewed. And that's pretty fantastic. So how does this differ from just the idea that that Umwelt idea? How does this just differ from the concept of there's not? Of course, we don't see objective reality. We see a subjective reality. We see a very small slice of it. And how does it? What elements of this theory that you've put together expand on that sort of foundation?
Well, so the Umwelt idea that von Uxkull had, I think, was very, very insightful for its time. He was pointing out that different organisms effectively have different perceptual worlds because they inhabit different niches. So what it's like to be a bat is very different for what it's like to be Homo sapiens. And so their perceptual worlds will be very different. And many neuroscientists and cognitive neuroscientists today like von Uxkull's idea, but the way they take it is they say the notion of an Umwelt means that different organisms see different parts of reality, right? The bat sees different parts of reality than we do. So their perceptual world might be very, very different from ours, because reality itself is very, very rich. And so different organisms can be tuned to different parts of that reality. And this was sort of J.J. Gibson's idea, too, in his ecological optics point of view, that different organisms would see different whatever they needed, you know, the affordances that they needed in for their specific niche. And so I agree up to a point that different organisms are in effectively different perceptual worlds. But where I disagree is that what these worlds are seeing different parts of the truth. I don't think that they're seeing the truth at all. I think a much better metaphor is to say that we have different user interfaces. So if you have, you know, a laptop computer and you're writing an email, and the icon for that email that you're writing to your friend is blue and rectangular and in the middle of your desktop, does that mean that the email itself inside your computer is blue and rectangular and in the middle of the computer? Well, of course not. That's silly. Anybody who thought that is mistaking the point of the interface. It's not there to show you the truth. It's there to hide the truth. You don't want to know about the diodes and resistors and voltages. If you had to know all that, you'd never get the email written. If you had to toggle voltages, good luck. You'd never finish the email. So the desktop interface is there to hide the truth, give you eye candy that lets you get the job done, whatever you need to do. And that's what evolution does for us. Our perceptual systems are desktops. They're interfaces. Space and time is our 3D desktop. Time is extra dimension. So three-dimensional space desktop with time. And then physical objects like tables and chairs are the icons in our desktop. And we evolved this perceptual interface not for it to show us the truth, but to hide that truth. We don't need to know the truth. And in fact, knowing the truth would get in the way, just like toggling voltages would stop you from doing an email. So that's where I differ from the Umwelt point of view, at least the standard interpretation of that point of view by my colleagues. They will say, yes, different organisms see the world in different ways. They effectively inhabit different perceptual worlds. But what they're really thinking is they're inhabiting different parts of the truth. And I'm saying, no, none of us, no species at any time has seen any aspect of the truth. We have user interfaces that are species specific that evolve for each different species to hide the truth from the species and give it little simple symbols that it can use to stay alive long enough to reproduce.
And you've modeled this. This isn't just that's what makes this so great, is that this is not just some pipe smoking perusing old textbooks and pipe smoking in front of the dorm room or whatever. This is you've modeled this in a very detailed way, and yes. And this has led you into this territory. And I'm hoping that up to this point, people listening they followed along, and that this makes sense. But now we're going to go into a place that's going to be more difficult, and this is this concept of conscious realism,
right?
Where, and I think that the way that this made more, when I was looking through the different things you've said, the thing that you said that made this make the most sense to me was when you were used the concept of a corpus callosotomy, a split brain patient, right, to help make sense of this. So if you could start there, I think that we could maybe get into this.
Right. So the reason I started to thinking about consciousness as a fundamental nature of reality is that, I mean, most of us, myself included, start off as physicalists. We assume that space and time and matter is the ultimate nature of reality. And the reason we believe that is because that's what we see. We look around and we see space and time and we see physical objects, and we assume that we've evolved to see reality as it is. And so we assume that space and time and matter is the ultimate nature of reality. And it's a simple mistake. We've mistaken our interface for the truth. It's like a person who thinks there really is a blue icon inside the computer. That's what physicalism is. It's that silly mistake.
And you're saying that goes all the way down to atoms and quarks and everything.
Right. It goes down to anything that's inside space and time. So even, you know, when the physicists like Rutherford told us a century ago that, a piece of metal that looks hard and solid isn't really mostly empty space. There's all these atoms and subatomic particles whizzing around in empty space. I mean, and so it's nothing like what we perceive. And that is true, and that's perhaps surprising, but I'm saying something even weirder. I'm saying that that is still in the desktop because those atoms are whizzing around in space and time. You haven't gotten outside of the desktop until you've let go of space and time itself. So I actually have a clear proposal that physicists are going to discover that space-time is doomed, that it's not part of the fundamental ontology that they can use in booting up a theory of physics. And already they're all over that. Nima Arkani Hamed, a professor of physics at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, has lectures on exactly that point, that space-time is doomed, and they're trying to figure out what will replace it. So that was why we've always believed that physical stuff that's non-conscious is fundamental. But now that we have to give that up, then the question is, well, what ontology shall we have? What is the nature of the ultimate reality? And the first answer is, you know, again, Homo sapiens may not be capable of understanding it. That's one possibility. We just can't know. But there's another possibility, and that is, you know, I may be wrong about everything I believe, and that's certainly possible, that maybe everything I believe is fundamentally wrong. But if I'm right about anything, I believe that I have conscious experiences. I believe that I have experiences of pain, taste of chocolate, smell of garlic, feelings of love, and so forth. I mean, if I'm wrong about that, I'm wrong about everything, we might as well just drink beer, have pizza, and have a good time. I mean, mm-hmm. because science is impossible. Mm-hmm. So I decided to, I said, look, evolution by natural selection entails that our perceptions of space and time and matter are not an insight into reality. Physicalism is false. Let's try to boot up a different theory of reality, but make it rigorous. I want a mathematically precise theory of reality. And so I said, let's start with consciousness because, you know, if I'm wrong about having consciousness, I'm wrong about everything. So let's just start there. And so I have a mathematically precise theory of consciousness. It's actually a mathematical model of consciousness that you can write down on the back of a napkin, but it's mathematically precise. And then a very strong claim that every aspect of conscious experiences and the dynamics of consciousness can be modeled without exception by this mathematical theory. So I'm probably wrong. I mean, that's the whole point of science, is to be absolutely precise, down to the mathematical nitpicking. Be very, very precise, make bold, bold claims so that people can then, you put a target on yourself, or not on your theory, you put a target on your theory so people can try to shoot it down. That's the whole spirit of science. So be very, very bold and precise so that we can, you know, shoot these theories down and then, you know, evolve them, make them. So I've got this theory of consciousness and then the bold claim that consciousness is fundamental, that the ultimate nature of reality is consciousness, what I call conscious agents. And if I'm right, then one prediction is that we'll be able to use this theory of consciousness to, with mathematical precision, get back what we call, you know, quantum mechanics, general relativity, and eventually even quantum gravity. In other words, we'll solve the mind-body problem, not by starting with physical stuff like neurons and trying to get consciousness to emerge from it, but going the other direction. Start with consciousness, mathematically, precisely defined and modeled, and show that we can get back quantum mechanics, general relativity, and eventually quantum gravity from it and solve the problem that way.
And so if it's not atoms and molecules, those are just representations on our desktop. What is it?
So the idea would be that if it's not some physical thing like space and time and matter, I'm proposing that the ultimate nature of reality is actually something that we feel somewhat intimately acquainted with, namely conscious experiences, fears, emotions, the smell of chocolate, the taste of garlic, and so forth. I'm not saying that we have, you know, deep, deep insights ourselves into those conscious experiences, but we do have conscious experiences. By using that as our foundation and making a mathematical model of it, we can then start to get a science of consciousness that is a rigorous science where we can actually get surprises, right? We might find out about things about our own consciousness that we would never have known if we hadn't got a mathematically rigorous theory of it.
How do we, what about, this is going to, I mean, please forgive my complete ignorance, but how do we, what about, How do we escape the possibility that math is also part of this desktop, that it's not, yes. That math itself is a human construct and doesn't help us model reality because it's just part of the, it's also trapped inside the desktop metaphor?
Great. That's a very, very important question. And it does distinguish my point of view from certain religious points of view that have tried to use evolution to take down science in a very different way. So Alvin Plantinga, for example, has used evolutionary arguments to say that all of our cognitive abilities are not reliable. And so, therefore, evolution sort of shoots itself in the foot. And my argument is very, very different. My argument only applies to one cognitive capacity, namely our perceptual capacities. It doesn't apply to our logic and math. And in fact, when you look at logic and math, a different analysis from evolution seems to apply. There are selection pressures to do certain elementary operations in logic and mathematics correctly. Two apples give me roughly twice the fitness payoff of one apple, right? It's about fitness. So that's the key thing. Evolution is all about fitness, not about truth. But when you're arguing and when you're doing reasoning about fitness, you do need to get that right. And so even though you're not arguing or reasoning about the truth, you do have to do the mathematics and logic correctly to get the fitness correct. And so although evolution by natural selection uniformly pushes or shapes our perceptions not to be true, it does not uniformly push our math and logic not to be true. There are small selection pressures. Now, by the way, on the other hand, I'm not saying that there are selection pressures to make us mathematical geniuses. Far from it. What there are these little enclaves of ability. So, you know, two apples are better than one in terms of fitness. Or in terms of us as a society, a social group. I mean, we're hunter-gatherers. We cooperated. At the end of the day, I would share what I got with you if you didn't have enough, and the next day I would expect you would share with me. But there's a logic of reciprocation that then evolves. I mean, I gave you some yesterday, the day before. In fact, I've been giving some to you for the last month, and gee, you've never given anything back to me. Now, wait a minute. So there's a little bit of logic that comes into play here, just a little bit, that says, you know, if I do this, then I expect this from you and vice versa. And so we get these little bastions of logic and mathematics that evolution gives us that are not there and designed to show us the truth just to make us fit, but then every once in a while the genes come together and you get a von Neumann or some other brilliant mathematician who really is, you know, a Kurt Gödel, who really is, you know, from our point of view, an outright genius in these areas. And so evolution by natural selection shapes our perceptions uniformly away from the truth, but it does not shape math and logic uniformly away from the truth. It gives us a little foothold here and there. And every once in a while, the genes come together and you get a real genius in these areas.
Well, let's see if we can help people understand this idea of conscious agents. You mentioned that a split brain patient, you know, basically has a person has one consciousness. And then a split brain patient, there are all those great experiments by Gazzaniga where they have them do all these amazing, we've talked about it on the show before. So there's a. In essence, in you could frame them as being a person with two consciousnesses. This consciousness is that are housed within one organism, and you can. I've seen in some of your work, you extend this. Why not divide it into four, and then 16, and then 45? And this it sort of reminds me of the Minsky stuff with the till you finally get down to little binary agents. So how does that plug into your concept of this conscious realism?
That's a great example. So we all feel as though we're a single consciousness, right? That's the way it feels subjectively. Sometimes we have inner conflicts, but it feels to us like we're, you know, pretty much one single consciousness. But it turns out that the way your brain is organized, there are two hemispheres, a left and a right hemisphere, that are connected by 200 to 225 million fibers, axons. So it's like think of it as a cable, a computer cable between two massive computers. And in certain bad cases of epilepsy where you have a part of the brain that's bad, say, on the right hemisphere, and sends random signals throughout the whole brain that make you go unconscious, they couldn't, in some cases, you know, fix it with drugs. And so Joe Bogan, who I had the the privilege of knowing while he was still alive, was a famous surgeon who would actually cure these people pretty much by, you know, taking off the cranium, taking a scalpel and cutting the corpus callosum and just splitting the two hemispheres, cutting off. And what it did was it confined the bad electrical activity to just one hemisphere. So one hemisphere might go down, but the other one wouldn't. And what they found was that in careful experiments, the two hemispheres actually, from my interpretation of it, is they have two separate kinds of consciousnesses in the following sense. You can ask a question of the right hemisphere and ask the same question of the left hemisphere, and you get different answers. For example, what do you want to be when you graduate? One fellow was asked this. The left hemisphere wanted to be a draftsman, and the right hemisphere wanted to be a race car driver. It couldn't be more different. They have different personalities, different likes and dislikes. They can play 20 questions with each other. You could literally set up a situation where the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere play 20 questions. And it's a real game because the two hemispheres have different contents of consciousness. So it feels to us like we're a single unified consciousness, and we might be, but just a simple knife, a scalpel, can cut your consciousness in two, and there are two separate spheres of consciousness. And so if two, then I point out, well, why not more? How far down might it go? I mean, Minsky had the notion of the society of mind, and I have a precise mathematical notion of what I call conscious agents that can be divided further and further until you get down to agents that are literally as simple as is possible. One bit of perception and one bit of action. Literally, you know, a zero or one for perception or a zero and one for action. And then the mathematics allows me to build up conscious agents as complex as humans.
That is so, I've got a book here. I've got a really old, I'll never find it. This reminds me so much of this old idea of the recursive universe from the Conway's Game of Life.
Oh, right. Yes.
And it feels so. It just feels like I really adore how there are. Many of these ideas seem to be converging within your theory. And so, and that instead of being sort of lost out there in Deepak Chopra land, they seem to be, in real academia. So, I'm wondering, how has this been received? I mean, how has this been received, by your peers and by people maybe in other, academic silos? I mean, I think at first glance, this feels like woo-woo. This feels like Deepak Chopra. This feels like, people talking about quantum consciousness and things that have generally been very poorly regarded in neuroscience and in psychology and other social sciences. How has this been received, and how do you feel about that?
Well, the initial reaction of my colleagues in academia is generally surprise and shock, but there are, you know, I'm doing the normal academic thing. I've published papers with mathematical models, and I actually go to conferences and to various universities and give colloquia where I present the mathematical models. And so it raises the bar. It would be one thing to say, I think consciousness is fundamental. That means that there's no beef there. But if to say, Here's the mathematical model of evolution by natural selection and what it does to our perceptual systems. And that clearly shows, and here's my theorem now, I've got a theorem and a proof, that says the probability that our perceptions of space and time and physical objects and physical causality, the probability that that's an insight into the nature of reality is zero. Now, so I put it out there. Anybody that wants to take a pot shot at me can. If they think there's some assumption in the theorem or some misstatement in the proof, fair enough, go for it. No one's found one. And this has been out for a long time. I published a paper with a couple of my colleagues over a year ago in one of the most prestigious journals, and 10 professors from around the world had a chance to write commentaries and take their best pot shots, and then we replied to them, right? And we came out just fine. Mm-hmm. So we're doing the normal academic thing of, you know, here's the precise mathematical theory. Here's the target. Take your shots at it. Mm-hmm. And if you hit, great, then we'll try to evolve the theory. If it's a devastating hit, then maybe we need to abandon it. So we're doing the normal scientific thing of, you know, trying to be precise and evolving the theory. So far, no one's been able to take it down.
Yeah. This is great. And I'm going to rip into this myself. I want to know if people who are listening to this are like, okay, I want to take a look at this. I want to understand it. And we have plenty of listeners who are in different, academic fields. I would like, how can they find you? How can they find your stuff? How can they start looking through it? And how can they get into what you're into?
So probably the easiest way, all of my papers and interviews and videos are in fact listed chronologically on my Vita. So if you just do a Google search for Donald Hoffman, Hoffman, you'll see on my homepage, there's a link to my Vita. It just says Vita. If you click on that, then you have everything I've done with hot links to free sources. So all of my papers are there. I published a paper, you'll see it on my Vita, in 2010 in the Journal of Theoretical Biology. It's the premier journal in the field. It's where all of the really major results in evolutionary biology have been published, the theoretical results. And we there have our Monte Carlo simulations where we show that evolution by natural selection never favors seeing reality as it is when you're competing against equal, complex perceptual systems. So it's right there. It's in the premier journal in the field, and you can go and read the mathematics for yourself. There's a Psychonomic Bulletin and Review published my target article last year with the 10 commentaries and replies. It's called The Interface Theory of Perception. That's the name of the article. And so you can download the article and read it. And then there's also my mathematical model of consciousness called Conscious Realism. The paper's called Objects of Consciousness. It came out just a year or two ago, and it's online for free. It's gotten, for a geek paper, it's pretty good. It's got 52,000 hits. Not bad for really geeky mathematics. The thing is math from start to finish. So it's not an easy read, but it's a precise theory of consciousness with a precise roadmap for how we could make connections with physics. So the ideas are all out there. The math is clear, and people can take shots at it because, you know, I'm not trying to wave my hands. I'm saying, here it is. Here's the mathematical details. Any questions?
I think that what you've done is unbelievably fascinating and challenging. And I hope that people seek you out and try to understand it deeply before they either absorb it without a question or dismiss it without question. So I really appreciate you giving us so much of your time. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much, David.
Letter C. Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things?
On each episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast, we close out the show with a cookie. A cookie sent in by a listener or a reader. If I eat the cookie that Mandy, my wife, bakes from the recipe sent in by you, one of our listeners, then you will receive a signed copy of either You Are Not So Smart, the first book, or You Are Now Less Dumb, the second. So, in this episode, and send those recipes to David at youarenotsosmart.com. This is this episode's recipe. It comes from Sophie Douse. Sophie Douse writes, "Hello, David. I stumbled upon your podcast not too long ago, and it's definitely become one of my top five podcasts. I wonder where it is. Is it 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5? I'm going to guess 3. And she says, thanks so much for shedding light on this ever so deep and utterly fascinating subject, the human mind's dead angles. I like that. In celebration to the multi-layers of your show, I offer you this cookie recipe, Alfa Jores or Dolce de Leche cookie sandwiches dipped in chocolate. They come from Argentina. I first tasted them in Brazil, actually, and now every once in a while, I'll stumble upon some, like once at the Ferry Building Market in San Francisco or in my hometown, Quebec City, from an Argentinian immigrant who started his little Alfajores business. Am I saying that correctly? Alfajores? Sorry. Either way, my mouth is watering. I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time getting through this. This isn't my recipe, but a recipe I found on the internet, which was very, very convincing, so I'm sure you will love them. Thanks again for your great show. Here's the recipe. Now, these are really cool. It takes a lot of prep on these, but it's worth it. I watched Mandy make these in stages. Some of it was done yesterday. You have to get all the dough prepared and put it in the refrigerator overnight, and then you take it out and you have to have a rolling pin and all sorts of stuff. There are several different kinds of things that go into it. It'll lay out the cookies, put heaps of stuff in the middle of the sandwiches after you bake the cookie pieces. It's crazy. The ingredients are flour and baking powder and salt and butter and sugar and orange zest and dulce de leche, bittersweet chocolate, heavy cream, amazing stuff. Okay, let's try this. What does it look like? It looks just like a moon pie. Now, I don't know if you know what a moon pie is. They are a staple of the Deep South from which I sprang. And they actually, there's a long story behind the moon pie and the company that bought them, and they have a moon pie drop every year in Alabama on New Year's. Anyway, that's what it looks like. But what does it taste like? Let's give it a shot. I can't wait to see what this is from Argentina and all over the world. Sophie Douse, here we go. That is right. That is right. You know, the best thing about this, it is a sandwich. Like, it's a very tiny sandwich. It looks like, you know, it's chocolate all over, very dark chocolate all over, but you bite into it and immediately the cross section is visible. Two cookies with some caramel type stuff in the middle. And it is so dark and chocolatey, very dark. The chocolate actually is kind of too bitter at first. It almost, you think maybe I've eaten poison, and then you very quickly start mixing the flavors of the cookie with the filling in the middle, and it all starts to blend together, and it becomes a very mature taste. I imagine, like, Agatha Christie would have this cookie on a very petite and elegant, beautiful little plate next to her dainty her tea, and she would drink her tea and take a bite of this, and it would be a whole afternoon surround. She planned her whole afternoon around how meticulously created this wonderful cookie is, and it does have many layers to it. So it's painful in the beginning, then complex, mature, and delicious in the middle, and it has many layers that mix together once you get to know it. This is a cookie that went to a foreign country, went to for the first time as a teenager, right out of high school, and thought that, you know what, I have figured everything out now, and I am so much more worldwise than my friends. But then somewhere in college meets someone else who did a very similar trip, and they had kind of the same experience, and they realized, you know what? I am coming online as a person, but it's not unique to me. And then a couple years later, after learning this over and over and over again, they accept that's part of life, and that actually makes them come online for real. That's what this cookie is. That's what this cookie feels like. This is a coming of age cookie. I'm thinking of this cookie as eating this cookie is just a metaphor for growing up and shedding all the ridiculous, superficial, transient and ephemeral concerns of childhood. It has layers like Westworld. It's complex and painful and comes online like consciousness itself. It's the perfect cookie for this episode. Thank you so much, Sophie Douse. A book is on its way.
Ichi, ni, ichi, ni, san, chi.
That is it for this episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. Please go to patreon.com/you are not so smart and pitch in to help bring a reporter to the show, I would like to add some staff to the show. A reporter would be a fantastic addition to the program, and we could put out content more along the lines of some of the podcasts that I've always wanted this show to sound like and be like. Adding a reporter would make that possible. So go to patreon.com/youarenotsosmart and help make that happen. You can find all past episodes at youarenotsosmart.com and at boingboing.net, where you can find other great podcasts like this one. Boingboingpodcast.com has all the podcasts listed. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. This music is Banjopocalypse. On Twitter, it's @NotSmartBlog. I'm @DavidMcCraney, and Facebook is just You Are Not So Smart. Oh yeah, we're going to talk about crickets one last time. Remember we talked about cricket powder and exoprotein? Well, go to exoprotein.com/sosmart. That's exoprotein.com/sosmart. And you can try 4 different bars for less than $10 made with nutrient-dense cricket powder. These protein bars were designed by a 3 Michelin-star chef. Good for the environment, good for you. exoprotein.com/sosmart.